Hello, Dr. Flint. This is Luke Durney, and this is my 10-5-2 final project. For my final project, I decided to do a PowerPoint with 10 lessons I've learned from this course, 5 lessons I've learned from my 15 years in teaching, and 2 goals I have for my future teaching. I'm going to start with the 10 lessons that I've learned from this course. Lesson number 1. You don't know Jack. Well, in this case, the you is me. I don't know Jack. I have a quote here from Make It Stick that says, "It turns out that much of what we've been doing as teachers and students isn't serving us well, but some comparatively simple changes can make a big difference." Many ideas about teaching I've found, while well-intentioned, are not as effective in practice as they ought be. It's interesting, education is a field where almost all the teachers I've talked to frequently early on think that they know everything there is to know about teaching without actually having a whole lot of research behind it. And in reading Make It Stick, I realized that I don't know nearly as much about teaching as I thought, specifically about how recall is best for learning as opposed to repetition. I really need to think critically about the efficacy of my own instruction and to tweak it and make it better in ways that best promote learning, and not just go off assumptions about necessarily what worked for me or antiquated assumptions from the past. It really good teaching involves critical reflection, and I need to do more of this. Lesson number 2, KUDs are king. My father asked me recently, I was teaching The Things They Carried by Tim O'Brien in my English 12 honors class. It's a fabulous book, one of my favorites. But he asked me something that really kind of caught me off guard, and he said, "Luke, why are you teaching this book?" And I didn't have a good answer for him. I sort of said, you know, it talks about storytelling, and it's a really, really great insight into the Vietnam War. But the fact of the matter was, I couldn't articulate exactly why I was teaching the book. I hadn't developed a KUD for the book. I hadn't said, okay, why am I teaching it? What skills am I trying to get at? What do I want the students to accomplish? What do I really want them to understand? I didn't have a clear goal. And as a result, just like it says in the Tomlinson book, students were asking me what's on the test and were trying to figure out what I was going to ask on the test rather than trying to like understand the material for the material's sake and to really get immersed in the material. So I found that I really need to really develop ideas and articulate those ideas about to myself and to my students about what I want them to capture and what I want them to learn, and that will help their academic success. This is something I had not previously considered prior to reading the Tomlinson and Moon book, and really between that and the question my dad asked me, it caught me off guard. So KUDs are king. Something we have to establish early on to get the students to really do their best work in the class. Lesson 3, coaches coach up. At my previous job at DeMatha Catholic High School in Hyattsville, Maryland, I used to coach cross country as the assistant cross country coach, which means I drove the bus. But one year we wanted to challenge our rival for the championship, and we really didn't have the players, as it were. We didn't have the horses to really challenge. And I said to the head coach, I said, "Wait a minute, how are we going to do this?" And he said, "Well, coach, we got to coach them up." And that didn't mean having small goals. It meant having a big goal. It meant we're going to win the championship, and we're going to scaffold our coaching so that we have this clearly established goal. And we're going to work everybody towards that goal. We were going to plan all of our tasks to reach that goal, no matter how advanced they were at a run, as a runner. Well, if coaches can coach up, teachers should teach of. I've always thought that I need to differentiate instruction based on a student's IQ or their, you know, their level in the class, but really I should be establishing a high goal. The higher students will get there, and then I can give the other students the scaffolding to get there as well. Teaching up is something I hadn't really considered prior to this class, and I think it's really important. I think that I need to come up with, I think to go along with KUDs, I need to have a set goal that's a really high and a lofty goal, whether that's writing a serious term paper, or next year I'm teaching AP English to the AP exam, and anybody can take that course with a waiver, so I'm going to have, definitely going to have to differentiate for some lower achieving students, but starting with a lofty goal and having everybody push towards that goal regardless of level. Which leads me to lesson four. Yeah, that's great. That's great and all, but you need to provide that scaffolding. Teaching up is a great idea, but unless scaffolding is provided for less advanced learners, only some students will be helped. I have to find ways so that students that are not as advanced can achieve that same lofty goal I'm setting for them. I can teach them up as well. I don't do a good job of this right now, I will admit. When in the NBA years ago, when Phil Jackson, the coach, won his ninth title, there was a lot of criticism from some players around the league, and it said, well, anybody can coach Kobe Bryant and Shaquille O'Neal. It's the coaches that coach the lesser talented teams that are really Hall of Fame coaches. And while I think Phil Jackson's incredible and innovator and all that, part of that rings true. It's the advanced learners are going to teach themselves. I mean, with them, it's kind of get out of the way, as it were. Let them do their thing. It's really, I think, the mark of a teacher, what you do with those students that are a little bit learning challenged and need that extra scaffolding. And I really need to find out where they are and to help them reach that goal. So what, like on AP English next year, for example, starting them with small parts of the test, having them not necessarily master a certain part of the test, but breaking the test up into chunks, or writing a major essay in Honors English 12. Right now I do a little bit of this with talking about primary quotes and secondary source quotes and outlines and then building towards the final paper. But I need to find ways within the curriculum, like teaching novels, that I can find ways to reach all of my students and give them the tools they need to succeed. Number five, lesson five, lenses matter. I found the Borich lenses of observation very interesting. When I was a first-year teacher, I used to get furious when students wouldn't do homework or they didn't take the course as serious as I did. And the vice principal at the time, Tom Burke, I'll never forget this, said, "You cannot assume that everybody in that class is Luke Durney." I was a very good student. I was valedictorian of my high school class, but I was self-motivated, or I said, you know, pressure from parents and other factors that made me really want to do well in school. And it never occurred to me that other students would not have the same drive that I had. And that really, his message really struck with me. Like, I was seeing the classroom through one particular lens. My own narrow lens. This place where I was, what I said was gospel, and students should just gravitate toward me no matter what I said or did. And a student's classroom experience may be radically different from my own experience. Do they feel comfortable in class? Do they think it's just this completely boring place? Do I see, Is it a nurturing classroom environment? Do I control the environment? There's so many ways to analyze what's going on in the classroom, and I have to be really careful that the way I perceive the class is close to or synonymous with the way the students perceive the class, because they could be radically different. I might think I'm being funny trying to relate to a student, and I might be belittling them accidentally. I might think that something I say up on the board is completely clear, and a student might have no idea what I'm saying. I went to a seminar years ago in Boston about reaching all learners called Learning in the Brain, and a neuropsychologist was up there talking about, interpretations of the world and how our view might not be the student's view. And he had a very funny line where he said, "What's obvious to you is obvious to you." And that's funny, and I joke about it with my wife sometimes, but it's true in teaching. I can't assume that how I perceive things in the classroom is how my students will perceive things. Lesson 6, why does this matter? Oh Lord, I wish I knew this when I was teaching Spanish. On the slide it says, according to expectancy value theory, student performance and effort is a multiplied function of how much the student enjoys the material and sees its value and their belief that they will succeed in mastering the material. If the students don't enjoy the material or see its value, they will not succeed in mastering it. They might get a good grade, but that's not the same thing as mastering it. I had many students in Honors Spanish 3 and even Honors Spanish 4 moving on to the AP level who could get an A and could tell me all the ins, they could tell me all the rules about Spanish, but they couldn't speak it. They couldn't really go into it. They weren't very motivated. They were motivated just to get a grade and then and get out of Dodge. They didn't sense any value, and I think that's because I was not good at articulating the value. Now, part of that's because Spanish is very difficult for a lot of people. It really is a foreign language. But thinking back on that this year in English class, since I've changed schools and states and some would say career paths, really, I've tried to find practical application in all of the texts I teach. For example, I teach Antigone, the famous play by Sophocles in the fall. And Antigone is appealing to the laws of the gods, and the king is appealing to the laws of the state, of man. And we talk about the laws of God and the laws of man. But then I put it in context with things like a Colorado cake baker ignoring the law of same-sex marriage in the United States, or civil rights leaders walking on Selma, or freedom riding, or sitting at lunch counters. When does morality trump the laws of the state, and what are the pitfalls therein? So I try to find books now that and make them applicable to the high school student's daily life and their life in college moving on. And I found this year that that gets them much more invested in the material, and they write beautifully about it on essays and evaluations. So I really think that finding that hook, finding that way to get them really invested in the material not only makes teaching more enjoyable, but it's going to make them enjoy the process and really enjoy being in class. It will also boost their performance. Lesson number 7. Recall is not memorization. In Make It Stick, it says, practice at retrieving new knowledge or skills from memory is a potent tool for learning and durable retention. It seems obvious now, but when I used to teach Spanish again, it was repetition, 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 repetition. And there is something to be said for that. Especially in a foreign language, you really have to drill and get it in. But rote memorization is not the same as effort for retrieval. Their retrieval can be structured in such a way where it's not rote memorization, where you really have to go back and think critically about what you've learned in the past. And it didn't occur to me that that could really be more effective for learning than just repeating it over and over. Although, curiously, after I had read this part of Make It Stick, I was teaching in my junior English class Brave New World by Aldous Huxley. And in it, in the future, everybody learns everything through sleep teaching, just hundreds of thousands of repetitions during sleep. And this one young man learns that the Nile is the longest river in the world. And he can say it over and over and over and over. Jimmy, what'd you learn last night? The Nile is the longest river in the world. And then the person says, Jimmy, what's the longest river in the world? And he breaks down crying because he doesn't know. And that, I think, is a beautiful illustration of this concept. Putting it in your head over and over doesn't necessarily mean you understand the concept behind it. And recall is so much more effective by tying concepts together and really getting students to understand the learning versus just regurgitating it. Lesson number 8, assess your assessment. As a young teacher, my colleagues and I, we all did this. were focused completely on summative assessment. We had to have quizzes and tests, and that was it. That was the be-all and end-all. Pre-assessment never even entered my mind. I never thought to see where students were. I never thought to think how where they were might shape my teaching. I just assumed a certain level of competency, and if they didn't meet it, well, too bad. I mean, I look back at my earlier teaching life. How arrogant was I? Pre-assessment, especially in things like math, foreign language, science to some extent, if it's a continuation of the course, you have to have pre-assessment. It's vital. But also, something that I find really interesting now is formative assessment. You know, ongoing throughout instruction and can guide how I relay my information. Sometimes now, in class, we have this really cool, great class website, and I do discussion boards with my students. And I might have them write a 5-minute discussion board on the previous day's lesson, or ask them to relate something to what we did a couple weeks ago. There's that recall concept again. But if their responses are not really good or detailed, I know that, hey, I need to do a better job of this. Or maybe they take the response in a way I totally didn't intend. You know, so if I examine my KUDs and what I want to get out of them, the formative assessment can help me assure that I'm heading towards the goal that I set. Or, you know what, maybe that's not the right goal I should be setting. Maybe it can help me guide me to a newer, better goal. But having assessment is key for that. Summative assessment, you know, occurs at the end and we all do it and that's fine. But I think pre-assessment, but particularly formative assessment, is an underutilized tool that could be extremely valuable in my own teaching and other people's teaching. Lesson 9, rethink order of practice. Repetitive practice is not the most effective way to recall information or practice learning. This blew me away. This absolutely blew me away. Currently, I direct plays. In addition to teaching English, I've directed, I'm currently, we're up next week, I'm directing my 20th play. And I found something really interesting. It started for me last year, and it continued this year, and it actually, now that I've read this, makes a lot of sense. I always thought that a scene had to be completely mastered before moving on to the next scene. Interleave practice. Whoa. I mean, wow. It's amazing to me that you can start a thing and then start a new thing and then start a new thing. And you don't want to start new all the time, but something doesn't have to be completely mastered before you move on to something else. You also don't need to do something necessarily every day. You can space out your practice. I just thought that was so cool. It really made me think, like, okay, as long as I'm committing to having my students learn a concept, the timing of that concept does not have to be as rigorous as I'm making it. In fact, if I spread it out and if I change it up, students might actually learn it better, which is something that had never occurred to me. Well, so in my play last year, this is what I did, and I'm doing it again this year. And it doesn't look like it's going to work. It looks like imminent disaster. And then at the end, all of a sudden, things weave together and it's just beautiful. So, lesson 9, rethink order of practice. And finally, lesson 10, I think this is the most important thing that I've learned. I sort of knew this before. I forget the name of the book. I had to read a book at my old job a couple years ago about this, but it really hammered home. Students have a lot of IQ levels, but IQ is not the metric that best measures academic success. I recall this now. I was valedictorian of my high school class, but the smartest guy in our class had a C average for a variety of reasons. He wasn't terribly motivated. He didn't really see the value in what we were doing. I don't know how he's doing overall. Maybe he just didn't have the grit. But then other students that really worked hard and weren't afraid to fail and get back up, they were the ones that succeeded the best. So it means so many things for the teacher. It means that the kids that struggle the most can achieve mastery. And if you really want to become an expert, you can. So what we need to do as teachers is cultivate in our students this growth mindset that, hey, you can fail, you can get knocked down, but if you really want to capture this, if you really want to work hard, you can achieve great things. I mean, there's motivation, but we're really looking for the students that stick with it and aren't afraid to get knocked off their pedestal and to get back up. Intelligence, obviously, is a helpful factor, but it's not the factor. And that, I think, is just remarkable. Self-discipline, grit, persistence, those are the things that really drive performance. And I'm not really sure how we can foster that in our students yet. This is one example I had trouble coming up with things because so few students, we live in this culture now where it's like instantaneous like gratification. And especially in a college prep school when parents are obsessed with grades. But if we could somehow articulate this to students and parents, I think it would be such a boost to the students' academic potentials because it's an amazing concept. Grit, not intelligence. And that will conclude my 10 lessons. Okay, on to the next section, which I call reflections. I've been teaching for a long time. This is my 15th year teaching, 13 at an all-boys school and 2 at a co-ed school in Raleigh, North Carolina. So I have 5 reflections about things that I was not good at and things that I've learned the hard way in my teaching career. So reflection number 1, with-itness is paramount to success. With-itness is a teaching term first described by educational theorist Jacob Kunin, and it describes that effective classroom management occurs when a teacher is omnipresent at all moments during an instructional period. It's a dynamic process in which a teacher must constantly monitor student behavior, forecast possible problems, and head them off, and be present to possible distractions at all moments. I used to think that you set the tone at the beginning of the year. And that's still true. A successful teacher does set the tone at the beginning of the year and establish rules and policies that can solicit a certain type of behavior from students, a behavior of reverence and respect, etc. But what did not occur to me then, which it does now, is that the classroom is really an organic being. It's this thing that's always changing and always that you always have to respond to. It makes sense. It's one of the reasons I teach. Going to work is never boring. No 2 days are the same in a high school. There's always something going on. But part of the reason that something's always going on is because the classroom really is this living, breathing thing. And as a teacher, you need to always be on guard. I mean, people say teachers have the eyes in the back of their head, but with-itness really says that you need to have eyes on all sides of your head to see problems, but also to forecast problems and to forecast their solutions, all while trying to do something else. It's something that I've gotten much better at, being more cognizant of it now. But now I know that it's when you're in a classroom, if you're not exhausted after a 45-minute class, you're not doing your job right. Because not only do you have to relay the material, but man, you have to make sure that everybody else is able to absorb the material because you've established and promoted and continue to promote and defend this safe space where students can learn free of interference from other students. Reflection number 2, grades are useful, but grades should be criterion-based, not comparative or norm-based. When students are compared with one another, they come to believe the goal is competition rather than personal improvement. As a young teacher, I frequently would establish contests and the winners would get better grades. While this was useful to some extent, I think, because it was at a boys' school and boys thrive on competition, I'm not sure it was the best for learning. I think it was the best for determining who was the best. You know, had bragging rights, but it took away the idea that success was hard work. It was like, so the students that were struggling would pair up with the smart students, and the smart students wouldn't want to be with the struggling students, and it students were not invested in their own learning. So it's a much better idea, I think, to get students to be judged on certain criterion, which is what a lot of teachers do anyway. But I realized later on that my reward system, which we also talked about in this course, and I'm going to talk about in Reflection 4, they're limited. So grades should not really be based on others, and they should not be compared with others. Certainly curves should not exist. They should really be based on a set standard of criterion, not relative to each other. Reflection 3, feedback is critical. A few years ago, I was asked to speak in a new teacher group, and I and some other colleagues were asked to speak, and they asked us to go around the room and say what we remembered. And a few colleagues said, "Well, I remember the thrill of being a first-year teacher." And another one said, "Well, I remember being totally scared. And honest to God, all I remember is being tired all the time." My first year teaching was an exercise in exhaustion. I would take a nap almost every day when I got home. The problem is, I didn't want to do any grading. I got home and I didn't want to do anything. I was done. I was spent. Well, the problem is, when you don't do any grading, you don't provide any feedback. And when you don't provide any feedback, it harms the teacher. It harms the student, but not only does it harm the student, it harms the teacher. Students don't know what they're doing. And in certain courses, math, foreign language, science, it's critical to get that feedback right away so they don't make the same mistake. It's a little bit less so in English, but still, students cannot improve if they don't know what they're doing wrong. So too with the teacher, which is something that never occurred to me as a young teacher. I remember thinking that, you know, if the students got something wrong, it was their fault. I was still communicating well. Well, one time I gave a midterm exam and my department chair said, "You need to do insert a sheet to see what the students got wrong." And there were a few questions that some students got like 75 to 80% and even 90% wrong in one case. And they weren't mistakes necessarily, but they were questions I thought were totally obvious. And the students were getting them wrong, and I thought, how could that be? And I realized I had not taught that well. So in this case, the feedback was critical for me to judge my own teaching and to see where I was being unclear. But I got that feedback right away because the students took the test and I put the Scantron through the machine, and it was great. You need to grade faster. Feedback needs to be consistently delivered, needs to be timely, needs to be clearly communicated. You also need to have the same kind of feedback every time you hand something back. Otherwise, the students get all confused about what you're trying to say. But feedback is such a useful tool when done correctly. It's critical to both student development and their learning and teacher development in their craft. Really, teaching is a craft. And to improve it, you need to know what you're doing well, but also what you are doing wrong, or not necessarily wrong, but what you can improve on. Reflection 4, rewards are limited. I talked about this earlier a little bit with competition, although it had a little bit more to do with grades. The pink lecture about rewards, oh my gosh, was that awesome. You would think that rewards get people to do better, and that's just false. As he says, rewards for simple tasks, but they're ineffective for complex tasks. I can give a little reward for doing the vocab exercise, getting it done earlier in the week, or doing the most amount of words, but rewards for something like a term paper or an essay or raising your hand the most with thoughtful questions, they just don't. It's just not good. Teachers need to consider what motivates students and attempt to increase that motivation through means other than rewards. Pink says that if motivation comes from autonomy, mastery, and purpose, my students need to feel like what they do has purpose. And they need to be aiming to achieve mastery. And they need to sort of sometimes feel like they can do it on their own. So much of this ties together, like with the lesson I learned earlier. You have to foster buy-in with your students. That's how you get them to do their best work. You have to let them see the value and then of what you're teaching, and then have them give them the tools to pursue it on kind of their own avenue towards success, towards mastery. Giving rewards on a level playing field just doesn't work as well. And finally, reflection five, be a teacher. I have a quote here from Richard Macheski, a history teacher, a new faculty mentor. He was my AP US history teacher, and then later my new faculty member. He's the finest teacher I've ever met, the best teacher I've ever had. Don't get the kids to like you. Get them to respect you. It's a fine line, and I'll talk a little bit about empathy in a minute, but you're the adults. As daunting as it is to manage a group of students, take charge, be assertive, and have plenty of with-itness. Kids will respect you if you have with-itness. Kids will respect you if you clearly provide feedback consistently. Kids will respect you if your grades are fair and they see that their hard work brings about a reward. But most specifically, you need to be the teacher. You need to take charge. You need to be a boss. It doesn't mean be mean, but it means be the teacher and they're the student. And if you do that, you will really ensure a great learning environment. There have been times in my career where I've tried to relate to them too much. I've tried to be too funny, tell too many jokes. And it just has not worked out well. The students are turned off by it, or they might say, yeah, he's funny, but I didn't learn anything. I've had a couple of students say in reviews, unsolicited reviews, but reviews nonetheless, like, I spent too much time trying to be the cool guy and not enough time doing the teaching. Your job's there to teach. Get the kids to respect you, and the rest will come after that. Okay, last section, my goals moving forward. In my future teaching career. I've been doing this a long time, and I don't see an end in sight, which is cool. Goal number one is empathy. A few years ago at that same conference in Boston, I went to a talk, and a guy talked about meeting kids where they are, and I thought he was ridiculous, quite frankly. I thought, no. This is not... The kids are not me. I set the standard, kind of like teach. It's funny, I was talking about teaching up, but without the scaffolding, which makes you wonder if it was teaching up or not. But no, you set the standard and the kids meet it. And who cares if they don't or not? I look back on that now and how just boneheadedly wrong it was. I think achieving empathy with your students is the best thing a teacher can do. And I think it's vital to classroom success and to the students' academic performance. Students need to be need to feel valued as human beings first and foremost. We need to place the individual learner at the center of the learning process. We need to get to know them as people, discover their likes, dislikes, talents, and personal challenges. Like I said before, not all students are Luke Durney, and I'm not the same as other students. You need to adapt instruction to the individual and practice empathy with them. That will get them to buy in. My nickname, as I've told you this entire course, is Sherpa. My kids call me Sherpa or Sherpa Dern. And the whole reason I kind of adopted this nickname and Twitter handle and everything else is because I'm their guide. We're on this journey together. I really want them to feel like I care about them, and I do care about them, and we care about each other. And when you do that in the classroom, both sides are mutually transformed. I've had just an incredible reaction from students since I adopted this whole mindset about being a Sherpa and about being their guide and trying to truly meet them where they are. My goal in the future is to get even better at this. I still occasionally dismiss students' concerns as trivial, and some of them are. It's hard to know the balance. It's hard to know who's genuinely struggling and really needs that extension versus who just hasn't done something. It's hard to know who's really struggling with something emotional and who's just tired because they were up all night partying. It's hard to differentiate between the two. I am going to try my best in the future to even go further with this concept and just really meet my students where they are and to try to really, really get to know them as people. I think that will foster buy-in. And but even besides that, I mean, it's so easy to forget that these students are students, but my students are mostly seniors and they're young adults. They're going off into the world. You know, no one likes to feel dismissed or trivialized, and I think that that teachers do that a lot of the time. I'm interested in their opinions as people. I value who they are as people. And I find that when I do that, I mean, the benefits are just outstanding for all parties, and that we all become better people. Yes, they're good at analyzing texts and writing about them, but we're all better people, and really isn't that the aim of all education? And goal number two is curiosity. Good teaching requires self-reflection. Teaching that becomes static inhibits classroom learning. I have to be totally truthful here. I'm very skeptical a lot of times of professional development. We just had a professional development clinic a month and a half ago at work, and it was a disaster. These people were all telling us how to be better teachers, but hilariously, none of them were teachers anymore. But that doesn't mean that all professional development is bad. Really successful teachers are curious about the learning process. And this is something I've really come into late in the game, because I used to think that my teaching was just the best and the students that didn't get it just didn't get it. It was their fault. But I need to learn new things and adapt more effective practices. I went to the National Council of Teachers of English conference in Houston back in November, and it was great. Oh my gosh, it was great. Learning new techniques and seeing what other colleagues, other people in the trenches were doing. It was such a great way to bring things back to the classroom. I got some great ideas about Shakespeare and actually teaching Shakespeare with the plays of August Wilson, which will be really cool. But man, it was just such this cool experience, and like professional development can be cool, especially getting ideas from colleagues, having a colleague observe you, not for any like, you know, job security way, not like formally, but just to get ideas, go observe a colleague, go on a learning walk, to be curious about the craft. And that's something that I want to continue to get better at my craft and to be more curious and to really investigate ways of improving my teaching. Well, Dr. Flint, that's it. Thank you so much for the course. And this is Luke Durney signing off. Thanks very much.